It is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. Besides joining us on a Friday morning and us rebroadcasting him on the weekend and next week, he's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He has his own site, themediabeat.us, and we say good morning. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. It's good to be with you.
It's nice to hear your voice again. And
good to be checking in. I have to say, good to be heard. It's often in these days of social isolation, every connection is a valuable mm-hmm. one.
Well, you know, it's things are interesting, and this generation is we today in Sharon. The state of Connecticut and the National Guard setting up another one of their field hospitals, which are being set up in advance because, of course, the people that have contracted COVID-19 after they get past the danger zone, they still need a week to 2 weeks in a hospital to recuperate, and the hospitals are filling up. So we are the third presence in the state to have a field hospital. There's going to be a couple of others. But it brings home the significance of, and more than ever, the word healthcare is just standing out in the news, whether it's said or not. It shows how fragile and really how unprepared nationally we are to help people of low incomes, minorities, battle with this unbelievable virus.
Yeah, absolutely, and the very closeness of it, the nearby locality, is one focus to take, and it's true, as you say, nationally, and also globally. I have a I have a sort of inbuilt veer towards taking the global view whenever I can, and I think we're at that point in this particular story, this vast stories, this cataclysmic stories development now, to not necessarily react to every single crescendo that might suddenly come, but pay attention to the steady worldwide drumbeat of it all. Take a global view. We're now at the point where, excuse me, we're now at the point where the global numbers of COVID-19 cases are rising fast towards 2 million. Of course, almost 500,000 of that in the United States. And I turn at times like this. Not that there are many times like this. This is an unprecedented assault on the world as a whole. But it's a time when you go to your most trusted sources. And in terms of taking a global view, I'm looking these days, not just to actual, broadcasting media and print media, but to those institutions that trade in information in a much more, what you might say, independent view. They're not in the business of getting audiences, but institutions that look into the questions that are at stake here. And I tend to veer, as a transatlantic person, between two sources of institutional analysis. One is British and one is American, and they were both formed at the same time after another cataclysm, in fact, after the First World War in Britain. They came out as a sort of side effect of the Paris Peace Conference that negotiated settlements after that most appalling war that was known then as the Great War. The global system was so jarred by it all that it was felt that new institutions were needed, and in Britain, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, otherwise known as Chatham House because of the building that it's in, was formed. And in New York, we have the Council on Foreign Relations. The Royal Institute, by the way, sometimes goes by the name British Institute. It doesn't. Not all its members like the idea of being a royal organization, but they were given a royal charter by the King, who's the father of the present Queen. But these are stalwart organizations that work on, as I say, the analysis of problems and true to their original mission back in the post-war era of 1920, to ensure international understanding, to really appreciate the forces at work, and maybe understand better how to fend off massive shocks to the system, like the First World War was, and clearly coronavirus is proving to be now. And one of the things that they're reporting on, and I can report now, it's very clear the connection between health system quality and a country's economic capability. It's very clear from the research being done at Chatham House now that the top 10 best performing countries on economic growth actually includes 8 of the best performing countries when it comes to handling the coronavirus crisis. In particular, the top 3 are in fact Asian countries: Singapore, Hong Kong, and South Korea. And they've ended up being exemplary to the rest of us on how to deal with this horrible shock to the system. And it's a lesson for the world as a whole now to consider always the quality of a country's health system as being just as important as any other more economically minded indicator to assess the ability of any country to deal with a major shock.
You know, it's interesting to compare, you know, in a pandemic like this, you can take a look at our healthcare system, and we definitely have one of the best healthcare systems in the world.
For some people, yes.
Yeah,
for those who can afford it.
That's the big difference.
I don't know why I laugh. It's no laughing matter.
Well, you have to laugh because there's so many people in this country that don't realize that yes, we have all the availability things. We have the technology. We have the machinery. We have the people. We have the hospitals. But we don't have the access. And that is one of the biggest things that we're starting to see now with these numbers that are coming out from all these different cities, major metropolitan cities, but still, it proves the same point, that a disproportionate number of people getting this disease and dying from this disease are people that are of a lesser income. And quite frankly, ethnicity. If you're black or brown, your chances of getting this and surviving this are far worse than anybody who's white.
Yeah, that's proven on the ground. That's being proven on the ground in places like Chicago with the black population, and you know, bringing it closer to home for me, out on Long Island, the Hispanic population is suffering the most. Those facts are clear, and the other in the broad international view again, fact is clear that this is that like many shocks to the system, you can't handle it purely as a nation. Alone, either international cooperation is essential. You know, which is somewhat in question in some ways. I mean, the shock to the system is producing a certain amount of anti-internationalism too, of course, because countries are inevitably tempted, and some are actually doing it, hunkering down and closing their borders and such like, and treating the problem much more as if it were a domestic issue. And not the global issue that it clearly is. Although every country, of course, has to play its own full part in doing battle, not just defending, taking a defensive, crouching posture against the disease, but actually going out there and actively working on countering it. It can't be cured, but it can be countered, it can be treated, and people can recover. And that's clearly that's going on, and it has to be a collaborative exercise worldwide, which makes the approach of the current United States administration so distressing to see. And perhaps we're only talking about the commander-in-chief, because once again, he was if the word is thinking, he was thinking aloud and talking about cutting the funding that America provides for the World Health Organization. Now, the World Health Organization is not a perfect institution. It's been shown to have been, have things go on with its assessment of this crisis that are not perfect by any means at the beginning of it. But they've been doing a sterling job since then of correlating and coordinating countries' efforts. And it's rather shocking to see from the podium of the White House the things being said about the World Health Organization that have been said. It's so counterproductive to the idea of a global war on this disease. Now, if we're going to fight amongst ourselves about the way to do it and to withdraw money from the collaborative effort that is being made, then, of course, the moment that the president was challenged on his idea, his statement, a very clear statement, that he was going to cut off the funds, he said, "I'm only thinking about it. I'm not actually doing it yet. I'm not quoting him directly, of course, but that was the message. I am considering it. It's a possibility. And we've seen this kind of presidential thinking aloud before, and it's grossly inappropriate. But what we have here is the most appalling sort of dark side of people's sense of their place, a country's sense of their place in the world. And what we've ended up now in a horribly personalized form of it, the Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom, who's from Ethiopia, has been receiving death threats and racist slurs about the word is most often used is Negro, which has a strange resonance in this context. And he, of course, is saying, "Well, this is appalling, but I'm not going to be put off by it." But you can see it as a sort of knock-on effect of the sort of extraordinary sort of combative approach that this administration takes almost by instinct to situations in which collaborative effort is required, not combat.
Looking at these news conferences that are held every day, I just it is somewhat embarrassing and somewhat perplexing is that the give and take. I criticize the president and for the way he's handled this, but also at these press conferences, I don't understand the press. One question I've been waiting for them to ask at this, with the rollout of this $1 trillion stimulus package, nobody has asked since day one how well it's being rolled out. They allowed the president to say, "Well, on first day we handed out $3.5 billion." Yeah, that was through one bank, Bank of America. The rest of the rollout, quite frankly, has been terrible. And
the loans that are supposed to support small businesses too. I'm thinking initially, and as you say, through the Bank of America for the main issuance of money to taxpayers. By way, I think the basic line is $1,200 to per person. But yes, the Small Businesses Administration is in a complete logjam now and can't cope with that. So the administration is asking to be judged by its intentions, not its actual practice. And of course, you're quite right. We should be questioning the effectiveness of their practice. And if the money can't reach people now, the promise that it will reach them eventually is just not going to cut it.
And all I remember is with the rollout, with the busted rollout of President Obama's Affordable Health Care Act, how everybody was outraged. Well, I mean, you should be outraged with what's going on with this. We have, we have businesses and we have restaurants. Now you're looking at millions of restaurant employees who are out of work. You're looking at millions of store owners and their their people that work for them out of work. You know, you can bring it down to the local avenue, like here. We here have 9 full-time employees at Tri-State Public Communications regarding not only the radio station, but our access television station and
the bargain. Well, you classically qualify as a small business. I mean, I think the rule of thumb is that if you have under 500 employees, you qualify for this additional help, so-called, that's meant to be coming to you. Yeah, and you certainly do, of course.
And we have not furloughed, cut anybody's pay, or we have continued to pay everybody, even though there's a lot of people that aren't working, simply because they need to exist, and we need them around to help rebuild everything when everything finally clears up. And this is where the press fails me to start attacking and getting more information on why this help is taking so long to get to businesses. And here in the state of Connecticut, you realize that in 2 days last week, unemployment claims were filed in the state of Connecticut, which would have amounted to 6 months' worth of unemployment claims. So people who've even filed for unemployment are literally months away from getting it.
Yeah, absolutely. And nationwide, we're now at the figure of 17 million, which is extraordinary, since it was down at only at about 6 million 3 weeks ago. Yes, the massive onslaught on all our institutions and our effective working organizations for governmental support of the population are shown to be very prone to seizing up and not being appropriately effective when the time really cries out for instant remedies. So not remedies necessary for the whole situation, but these efforts to alleviate the condition are falling foul of organizational and logistical problems that seem inevitable, but they should have been foreseen and should have been forestalled.
Well, let's turn on to our good friend Boris Johnson. He's still in the hospital, but he's out of ICU, and that is good news.
That's improvement, yes. But his case is interesting. He's not elderly. He's in a fairly robust state of health, generally speaking. But he did display a pattern which is evidently typical of the progress of COVID-19 when it takes a hold of a patient, is that it can be reasonably not too badly affected initially, but then the condition can take a very serious deteriorating course after a few days, and in his case, after about 10 days. His condition worsened so much that he did have to be hospitalized and put in the ICU and given oxygen, not in that constant form that a ventilator provides, but he was treated with oxygen in the ICU. He was there 2 nights. Very serious condition he was in, but now it seems getting better. So he's on the road to recovery, but as you opened today's session, Marshall, by talking about the ongoing need for care when people have gotten over the worst of COVID-19, as is evident, and which will be happening in your field hospital being built in Sharon, that goes for every single patient. And Boris Johnson, as much as anybody else, he's going to have to be taken care of in a very serious manner and determined manner for some time to come. I think the country can expect him to be a non-functioning chief executive for a while, and the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, will have to continue his stand-in role in the Prime Minister's place.
It's that's the thing about this disease, and what we've been trying to preach up here is that there have been some people who are upset that other people from other counties and maybe other states are going to be coming in to get to get healthy again, and we are trying to plead with people, what if our hospital is full and there wasn't another hospital that you could be sent to as an overflow patient. I mean, there has to be a little humanity that works in with not in our town, please. There has to be that humanity that we're all in this together, and that's the only way that this whole thing's going to come to an end.
Well, pandemics and cataclysmic events of all kinds really have that capacity for bringing out great heroism in amongst humans, but also the possibility of a dark side. And the tension has been very clear. I was just talking about it on an international level just now, but it obviously operates on local levels too. You can either be collaborative and determined to spread your capacity for help across as many people as possible, whether they're your immediate neighbors or further away neighbors, or you can hunker down and try and pretend that you can get through this on your own in some way, and that you don't need to be connected to the outside world at all in order to make things better. Collaboration seems to be a necessity for human beings when major crises happen, and the unhappy thing about it is that there are slews of individuals and sometimes movements based on the idea that no, we're not going to help other people in this crisis. We're only going to take care of ourselves and our own.
Now, taking a look at somebody who's been covering lots of different stories for a long period of time, and yes, we've had the SARS, we've had Ebola, we've had other pandemics and bad situations. Take a look at this, and how does this rank, in your view, with world coverage, with media coverage, and with importance? Basically, I think every once in a while, the human race comes into a situation where life is never the same after it. Is this one of those cases?
I think this is one of those occasions where global change is thoroughgoing and will be lasting. I really do. The economic blow that has been consequent on the medical blow and epidemiological blow is unparalleled. We're now talking about numbers that exceed what was happening in the Great Depression of the late 20s and early 30s. I don't think it's possible for the world to be unchanged by this. We may want to go back to things as they were to a large degree when this is all over. But I think that simply can't be true for every single aspect of our lives. I think one thing that is going to come out, and I think it is. I mean, I may be basing this more on hope than knowledge, but that's the way my mind works. I do believe that one of the things that will come out of it is an increased sense, as if it wasn't already appreciated in many parts of the world, just as a matter of course, but increased in those areas where it has been low, the notion that healthcare can somehow be a commodity that can be traded rather than be a right that should be, you know, made universally available, as universally available as an economy can manage to make it. That's the size of it. I think it's going to be that important and that life-changing for all of us.
Isn't it amazing how what Bernie Sanders, now that he's dropped out, has said all along, healthcare is a human right, and he was ridiculed by so many different people for saying that, and now we see how true and important it was that the healthcare for all the population, because you know what, in a pandemic like this, maybe a white healthy people don't have the factor where they're going to pass away or be sicker than people of less income and people of color, but when the people who do all that work for you, that have helped you become a very wealthy person, can't go to work and work is shut down, you see how Medicare and health for all really does level the playing field.
Yeah, access to universal health care, Universal access to healthcare, yes, is a human right. That does sound like a radical slogan to some American ears, but clearly the case of coronavirus has demonstrated that it doesn't ring so strangely anymore. Worldwide now, I think there's a unanimity of feeling about that.
Well, David, we want you to keep safe and keep reporting and keep following the media, and we'll speak to you again next week.
Look forward to that.
Take care. David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robinhood Radio. You can also find him at themediabeat.us and on demand, robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand, click on David Tarachuk and Media Beat.